Ever since Dr. Barry Marshall from the University of Western Australia ingested the bacterium H. pylori to prove that they were the cause of gastric ulcers, for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 2005, it seems that not all these bacteria are created equal in terms of their cancer-causing potential. Researchers from Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center recently published a study in the Journal of Biological Chemistry demonstrating how some of these strains protect themselves from the immune system. And I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Richard Peake, researcher and professor of medicine and director of gastroenterology, hepatology and nutrition, and professor of cancer biology at the Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure for me to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, and you're very welcome. And I'm very excited to have you on the show because of some of the other researchers that have looked at how bacteria tend to protect themselves in order to survive, especially disease-causing organisms. And I wanted to start first and ask you, how many people suffer from H. pylori-induced either gastric or duodenal ulcers in North America?
So you can estimate that approximately 50% of the entire population is infected with H. pylori. But of those people that are infected, about 10 to 15% actually develop duodenal or gastric ulcers. And even a smaller fraction go on to progress to gastric cancer, and that's ranges between 1 to 3%. So half the population's infected, but among the infected population, only 10 to 15% will actually develop clinically apparent disease, such as ulcers or cancer.
What is the source of this? Does the bacteria pass from person to person in terms of colonization?
Yeah, so that's the prevailing hypothesis. It's a difficult hypothesis to test because by the time you diagnosed the patients, most of them have been infected for years. So what we do know is that most infections occur during childhood and transmission is person to person. There have been some experiments in which patients who are infected with H. pylori have been given cathartics or medicines to induce vomiting, and they can actually identify viable bacteria in those specimens. So on the basis of that, people have postulated that it's really spread in childhood by, you know, a fecal-oral route or oral-oral, perhaps during bouts of gastroenteritis.
I wanted to look at the pathophysiology of this particular organism in terms of how it causes or develops the ulcers and even the cancers, and link that into some of the clues in previous research that led to development of your study. So when you were looking at how the mechanism of disease works in this condition, what were some of the clues that said, you know, let's try and look for a better understanding of how this actually happens?
Sure. So, you know, I guess the first caveat was years ago it was realized that among the billions of people who are infected with the bacteria worldwide, you know, only a fraction developed either ulcers or cancer. And so that raised several different possibilities. And one is that the bacteria may have strain-specific constituents that can, you know, augment the development of disease, you know, per se virulence factors. There could be different host responses to the bacteria. And then finally, environmental factors such as diet and other things could also contribute to this disparity in disease outcome. And so in 1992, a group from Italy and a group from the United States identified a virulence locus within the bacteria, which is called the CAG pathogenicity island. And this is a group of genes that really encodes proteins that function as a molecular syringe that can transport bacterial proteins into host epithelial cells following attachment of the bacteria to the gastric epithelium. And it was quickly realized that the majority of people that strains who contain this cassette of genes increase the risk of cancer and ulcer disease. So from the outset, it appeared that there were strain-specific genes that seemed to augment the development of disease. And at that time, I was training with a person named Dr. Martin Blaser at Vanderbilt, and he was very interested in identifying some of these strain-specific genes that may lead to disease. And so that's where we started to focus our efforts on this pathogenicity island. And strains that harbor this island increase the risk for gastric cancer. They increase the risk for ulcer disease. And we had developed mutational strategies in which we could start to knock out some of these genes in the bacteria and then see if the mutant strains affected gastric epithelial cells in culture or affected animal models of H. pylori differently than the wild-type strains. So that's sort of the background that led us into the area of research that we're involved with now, which is really looking at strain-specific H. pylori factors that mediate different epithelial responses that lower the threshold for gastric cancer.
So in the study in the Journal of Biological Chemistry, what was its design?
So we had identified several years ago that H. pylori binds very avidly to gastric epithelial cells. And if you look in the stomach of infected individuals, the majority of bacteria are they're extracellular or they're binding to gastric epithelial cells. So we thought that this binding phenomenon was important in pathogenesis, especially since the bacteria contained a pathogenicity island that could inject proteins into the host cell. So we were interested in identifying from the bacterial side some of the factors that may bind to the host cells, but also from the host side, we were interested in what receptors were interacting with the bacteria to allow it to come into contact and actually translocate some of the bacterial proteins into the cells. So we had collaborated with a group at Washington University that worked on a protein called decay accelerating factor. And this factor was originally described as a factor on red blood cells that prevents complement-mediated lysis of red cells. But earlier work in the 1990s had shown that other organisms, such as Coxsackie viruses or echoviruses and certain strains of E. coli, could actually co-opt or usurp this protein and use it as a receptor. And many of those organisms caused chronic disease. The E. coli strain that can bind to DAF causes chronic urinary tract infections. And because H. pylori is a chronic infection of the stomach, we hypothesized that H. pylori may actually also utilize this receptor. Another piece of evidence that supported the rationale for doing this work was that when researchers used immunohistochemistry to look for expression of DAF protein in the stomach, they found that it was only expressed at low levels in uninfected stomachs. But when people were infected with H. pylori, the expression of the receptor went up, or this protein went up markedly. So we thought that this was a good justification to go ahead and see if H. pylori could utilize this as a receptor. And so we did some studies with cells in which we transfected the receptor in or did a control where we just had a vector in those cells. And we found when we added H. pylori to the cells, they bound very, very avidly to cells that expressed DAF. So this was our first clue that there was a potent interaction between H. pylori and the DAF protein. And then that led to the studies that were reported in the Journal of Biological Chemistry in which we tried to understand how H. pylori actually regulated expression of that receptor. And then what happened when we infected our animal models of gastric cancer as regards to the receptor's expression.
So what were the results? What did you find in those animal models?
So it was very interesting. We found that first when we infected the animals with H. pylori, we saw the DAF protein go up markedly, and it only was upregulated in cells where the bacteria were binding. So that was an important clue because it really recapitulated what we had found in the lab. The more exciting thing was when we had shown in the lab that if we knocked out some of the genes in H. pylori that were in that CAG pathogenicity island, that H. pylori then lost the ability to upregulate the DAF protein in cells and culture. And so we generated a mutant strain of H. pylori and infected that along with our wild-type bacteria in an animal model of gastric cancer. And we found that the wild-type strain was able to robustly induce expression of DAF. But when we infected animals with a mutant strain that lacked that specific CAG protein, there was no upregulation of DAF, again, suggesting that strains that are associated with gastric cancer in humans are able to specifically manipulate upregulation of the receptor in an animal model.
So that would imply then that if we could either turn off specific genes or switches in these in those strains of H. pylori, or target those specific H. pylori bacterium, you will dramatically reduce, or at least certainly reduce the risk of transforming those cells into cancerous cells.
Absolutely. And the other target is actually the DAF protein itself. If there was any way that we could develop small molecule inhibitors of the interaction between the bacteria and the DAF protein in the stomach, then that potentially could, like you say, limit the progression to carcinogenesis. We had actually shown in an earlier study that when we infected mice that lacked DAF, so these were DAF knockout mice, we found very, very minimal inflammation compared to the situation when we infected wild-type mice with H. pylori. So H. pylori not only can upregulate this receptor, but it also seems to be important in mediating the inflammatory response to the bacteria.
What are the next steps in your research?
So one obvious step is we'd like to identify the bacterial protein that actually comes into physical contact with the DAF protein. We have not done that yet. It does not seem to be one of the CAG proteins. So that would allow us to identify a ligand on the bacteria, which we could then target, you know, as far as therapeutic trials in the future. We'd also like to determine, you know, what happens when H. pylori binds DAF. There are studies looking at viruses, Coxsackie viruses specifically, which have shown that when the virus binds to DAF, it actually acts as a carrier, and the DAF protein takes the virus over to tight junctions, which connect, you know, epithelial cells together. And at that point, the virus is transferred to another receptor. And that actually triggers intracellular signaling pathways that seem to be important in pathogenesis. So we'd like to understand whether the same pattern is occurring when H. pylori binds to DAF, because it's been shown previously that H. pylori can bind also to some of the tight junction proteins. And, you know, just as the case with intestinal pathogens, if you disrupt the barrier function between epithelial cells, then that can allow whole bacteria or bacterial antigens to go into the spaces that exist between cells and come into contact with receptors that are normally secluded from the gastrointestinal lumen. And that can trigger a lot of pro-inflammatory pathways.
Dr. Richard Peek is researcher and professor of medicine and director of gastroenterology, hepatology, and nutrition, and professor of cancer biology at the Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center. And Dr. Peek, I'd like to thank you very much for providing a really neat insight into the mechanism of how H. pylori can induce, or at least it certainly is linked to, inducing cancerous change in gastrointestinal tract, especially the stomach. And I'd also like to invite you to come back once the other areas of research, as you mentioned, that you want to follow up on, to follow this and see where it goes.
It would be an honor for me to do that. And thank you so much for letting me participate in your program.
Oh, you're very welcome. All the best.
Okay.